Right, everyone, that's it, please. We're almost to the final section. Yes, actually, if anyone wants to do a bit closer, the ranks have thinned out, that's all to do so. Well, for this final panel discussion that Jenny is leading, this is examining what does having a data mindset or a data-centric approach mean. So I'm not going to say anything further. Okay. About half an hour.
Right. Okay, so thank you everyone for staying on for this panel discussion, and thank you to Bill, Glenn, David, Andrew, Victoria and Steve for agreeing to take part. The idea, I think you were set a question at the beginning of the day, I think you were sort of set this question about what does a data-centric mindset mean, what does having a kind of data-centric approach in this kind of world mean, and that's what we're going to try and explore a bit now. Okay. Now, I like leading because I can now be quiet because I've asked everybody on the panel to prepare their minute on this question. So we're going to have a range of answers. Then we're going to sort of allow the panel to maybe comment on each other's answers. And then we're going to throw it open to you and you can interrogate us and see what you think. Because you've heard a lot about data today and where's it left you? So who's going to start? Now we're going to have this. It's like being my teacher. It's Bill. It's got to be Bill. Yeah.
Is this working? It is vaguely, isn't it? Yes, okay. Okay. I mean, I've no idea what other people are going to say, obviously. And so I'm a practitioner. and I think one could get very bogged down in the semantics of this if one really wanted to. But sort of building on what I was sort of saying this morning, and again, in the context of metadata relating to our collections and their access. I think key to what we mean by this is structuring the information, structuring our data, at a very very simple way of looking at it. And I think actually we've been doing that now for quite a long time. So if I look around, and not everybody in the room will remember this, but 20 years ago we had paper catalogues, and that's what we had. And paper catalogues were really useful. People came to our reading rooms, they looked at paper catalogue, and they found stuff if they were lucky. But effectively, you can only use a catalogue as a catalogue. It's a closed thing. You can't really do anything else with it. In the meantime, the world has obviously changed greatly, and we have moved. We have been on a journey. So we now understand that we have data about our material. We call it metadata. And we've looked at how that data is structured in our standards, and we've developed tools, ML tools, and so on, EAD, and so on and so forth, to put that structure into an online world. And we have catalogues up that people can search, and they can navigate that information. But for me, that's still it's better, but it's still quite close. And in the meantime, the digital world space thing is galloping, I think what it does provide us with is real opportunities, to get our materials, to get our collections in front of people perhaps that would otherwise never see them, in spaces where they would never see them, in contexts in which previously they, as it were, we need to continue in some ways doing what we're doing. I think crucially we continue to do it, but we can't continue to do it just on our own. And I think we need to be doing it with partners, with others, with other people in the cultural heritage space, in other spaces, and so on. And so I think we continue to develop our understanding, we continue to do modelling. I talked earlier about the effort that ICA is undertaking with the conceptual model for archives, and bringing that to other people's models. We continue to look at referencing our data, external vocabularies and so on and so forth. And we look to improving the quality of our legacy.
Glenn,
okay.
It's your turn
now.
Can
you hear me there? I think I'm on. I think something I touched on earlier, it's really, we all use the word data. I think it's important to kind of arrive at what some form of definition of what data means to you or your organization. Because, it's all data, everything from your HR data right down to, the Twitter feed. So at some level, it's important to get a definition for your organization of what data is to mean to you. And I think from that, try and extrapolate some tiers of value to that data that might guide how you treat it. Because, we can't keep it all, there's too much of it, and we certainly can't describe it all. So by extrapolating tiers of value, you can at least begin to prioritize, you know, beyond your maybe collection data, what is important. And I come again back to this kind of, you know, question of, you know, this journey from data to knowledge. You know, in 100 years' time, someone looking at that object, the Lampadius cross, you know, what do you want that to evoke for them? What do you want the data around that to evoke for them? If you can begin to kind of prioritize what is the data that is valuable to create that knowledge, then you know what to kind of do. So rather than kind of just photographing things endlessly, 3D scanning them, measuring them, describing them, you know, what's most valuable is the oral history story of the carpenter who made that, people on the island who took the migrants, the refugees, were drowning and saved them. You know, that carpenter made a cross for every single person who survived, 155 people, and made one for the Pope and the British Museum. So there is a story there around that that actually is beyond kind of just the simple classification of that as an object. And for me, that is the data that is almost most valuable. It's the data that will allow people to have that knowledge in 100 years' time about that object that somehow kind of is in harmony with what I feel about that as an object. And I guess that's what you want to have, you know. And I think back, I have a great interest in traditional Irish music, you know, and I have all the recordings of a very famous fiddle player from Sligo called Michael Coleman from the 1920s, you know, which is about 21 sides in all. And I would give them all up if I could just have an hour of, you know, Michael Coleman in his New York apartment having a house dance with his neighbours from Sligo who all emigrated to New York, just playing music and talking, you know. That's the kind of what I want. And you know, the sides give me some of that, the commercial recordings give me something there, but I kind of have to extrapolate all kinds of things. So for me, it is about this question of data to knowledge. And I think as an organisation, what is really valuable is to get, you know, your key decision makers, your archivists, your information managers, your curators, your keepers, you know, balanced technically with the curatorial side and really say, what does data mean to us and what is the kind of tier of value extrapolate from this so it gives us a clue on what to focus on.
Lesson number one, don't cough into your mic. Sorry. Okay then, I could give you the information manager's answer to this, a talk around availability, making sure data is available, the completeness, all that sort of stuff. And that is really, really close to my heart. But since I've got a minute or maybe a minute and a half, there's a couple of things that which get me very excited about data. And one of them is having an opportunity to explore the art of the possible with lots of new and exciting things. I did some tap dancing, apparently. That was good. Who was that? About 5 years ago, I did a talk about potential future for information management. And I talked about something that I was very excited about called semantic search engines. See, I live in a very boring world. I got very excited about the potential for semantic search engines. And there we are now with Office 365, with Microsoft's semantic search engine built into the product. There is one of the little nice little tiles you can click is something called Delve. That is really scary because it learns your search behavior across anything that you have access to. So quite a lot of my clients have got very scared because they've realized that we actually have a quite transparent approach and people can actually see their stuff. You know, it's all quite... So that's one thing I'm very excited about. Virtual reality, there's some really good virtual reality work being done by people probably in this room, which gives access for people through the net to historical archives, to pictures and paintings in some really exciting and imagining ways. Augmented reality is something else that I think is really exciting, and my company are working with certain universities in projects using augmented reality, so a lot of stuff can go through there. And the only other thing I wanted to talk about was having a very flexible approach. Now, if you don't mind, I'm just going to tell you a little story. It's a bit of psychology. I was at a conference a few years ago, and the CEO from a company stood up, and he talked about some new work that is being done in California. And they're actually CAT scanning digital natives, our under 30s. And what they were discovering was that their brains were actually wired differently from us older folk. And it is mainly due to, they think, all this new digital technology and the way they use it. So other people turn around and say, no, that's not true. With a lot of learning, there's about 7 different channels somebody could take it in at the same time. You've got to be trained to do it. So anyway, in the evening, I sat there when I was back home. My son was about 18 at the time, and there he was. We were watching the telly. He had Assassin's Creed on some little thing here. We'll go underneath as well. He was texting somebody using one of the, I think it was one of the chat ones. Not email. He just laughs at me when I talk about email. That is so 1990s. So he was doing that. He was watching the telly, and he was having a conversation with us. I mean, I couldn't cope with the conversation and watching the telly. And what these CAT scans are suggesting is that a lot of people from in that generation can do a lot of stuff, but they don't retain it for very long. Whereas I gave up on FIFA 2002, I think it was, when I got slide tackle because you did something underneath. But I can usually remember things. So I started to think about that because we employ a lot of people who are under 30, and we are forcing them to use technology that is just so alien and old-fashioned to them. Again, email being the obvious one. I think about all the information management's view of the world of trying to get everybody to work in a really structured way, which is just so alien. So what I'm trying to do at JISC is actually look at different ways in which people can slice and dice their information to suit their learning styles. So that was it. Sorry, that went on a bit, but that's my story.
Bill, you want to come in, don't you? I can tell.
No,
it's all right. Okay.
What's he talking about?
So how am I doing for volume? Okay, good. Thank you. So when I was first asked to take part in a panel discussion about being data-centric, my first thought was, oh, yes, please, that sounds like a great idea. And my second thought was, I don't actually understand what being data-centric means or why it might be a good idea. Okay. Anyway, but my third thought was that I would struggle to think why being data centric or having a data mindset would be a good idea, because to me it sounded instinctively a bit like putting the cart before the horse. Because from my particular narrow perspective and the kind of data that I work with, that data is or should be the servant of the record and of the people interested in the record, rather than the other way around. But perhaps my instinct was letting me down, as so often. After all, to look at it just from my own narrow perspective again, catalogue data is what connects the would-be researcher to the record, and vice versa. So here at TNA, we tend to take quite an overtly user-centric approach to our work, and rightly so. And in other ways, we're also quite record-centric. As I said this morning, my state of the catalogue work is based on a records mindset. And putting those two things together makes me think that a useful and productive way to be data-centric is when having a data mindset allows us to strike a balance between focusing on the record and focusing on the user of the record. So, for instance, I explained this morning that many of TNA's catalogue data problems exist because a large proportion of the data predates and was not designed for the current mode of search, retrieval and presentation at all. So focusing on the data and improving that makes it a better bridge between the user and the record. So it's certainly possible to have data-centric in a bad way by fixating on the data to the exclusion of what that data is actually for. But what I hope and what I believe is that the allure of our wonderful records and of their creators, depositors and users, some of whom are wonderful too, will help to keep us in the archive sector away from the trap of being data-centric in a bad way and make us data-centric in a good way.
And because of working for a medical school, the school is one of the highest ranked research institutions in the country. So the message is always that we really need to manage our data properly. So I'm talking about the kind of research data, which I mentioned earlier. Here we're talking about health data, so there's especially sensitive information in there. And we're trying to do it the whole way through. So, for example, we get data from other sources as well. So it's not just data that we generate. So we have to look after data from other sources, such as the NHS, for the research project. So we need to make sure that we have things in place and meet lots of standards to manage that data properly. So I see it as kind of a whole continuum, if you like, about data where I work. So I don't have lots of different things on the internet. It's just some things that I do. It's not very useful at all, but sorry.
The nice thing about being the last one is you just go, well, what they said. I think being data focused has got three kind of distinct elements in my mind. Well, that was the three that came to me while I was thinking about this. The first one was that I think I laboured the point somewhat when I was... I think I laboured the point about being data-centric in making business decisions, so I won't go on too much about that. I think the other two aspects, and I think they've been touched on a little bit, one is the way in which data is now a two-way thing between both the people who are creating it and trying to give it and the people who are on the receiving end absorbing it. You have to understand the data they're pumping out to connect your data to it. So I think that was one of the things that I think is about being data-focused, as well as being our business decisions being driven by data, so that they're more focused and intelligent. But that connectivity between the users and the data we pump out, it's not a one-way street anymore. It's completely interrelated. And the third one, which has almost escaped my head for the minute in true fashion. Oh, yes. It's chaotic. I don't think it's structured anymore. I don't think our data can be structured anymore, and I think we embrace that. I think being data-centric is the only one of the centric words I'm sort of permitting myself to use from earlier, because one thing I've just realised is that almost all the time I have to absorb into our business and our needs another set of data and another set of needs and another requirement that comes in. And if we were fixed on one model, on one approach, we would never be able to meet all of those requirements and all those different varying needs. So the event-driven, event-centric methodology that was being talked about earlier, completely understand the need for it. We have to do that. Obviously, we have lots of events in the BBC. We have to pump out event data all the time, place in time, describing the event, absolutely critical to us, but I wouldn't structure ourselves around that. And in actual fact, I think most of our problems exist from lots of people having very fixed views of how data should be structured. So the chaotic element of it, and I don't think that that's a scary thing. I think we embrace it.
Now that's everybody. That's what everybody's got to say. We've got some themes coming out perhaps around maybe the differences between connectivity and structure. So the sort of structure implies a connectivity, but it's kind of a looser sort of connectivity in the structure. So we've got this sort of idea of connectivity, and that's not just within the data itself, but also with the connection between the data and the use of the data and the users of the data. So I felt we had that kind of theme coming out. And also perhaps a kind of flexibility with that, a kind of we cannot be in control. We have to be comfortable with being out of control as a kind of, that is perhaps a data-centric mindset. You have to be comfortable with being completely out of control most of the time, which is not a comfortable position to be in, perhaps. So, you know, I think maybe there's something in that. But I think what came out for me from what Glenn was saying was that there is still for all this chaos, there is something we still believe in, perhaps. There is a kind of, I'm not going to say truth, but there's a kind of story, a kind of narrative, a kind of purpose that we do kind of believe in within this profession that kind of keeps us rooted, however chaotic and interconnected everything else becomes. So I don't know if you've got any comments.
That's a lovely phrase when you said we're creating narratives. I think that's absolutely right. It's about creating different narratives, ensuring those narratives, you know, that's what you're saying, are fit for the future around that data.
Yeah, and maybe allowing future audiences to construct other narratives.
Absolutely, yeah.
But give them enough things to do that with, yeah. So that those narratives are kind of authentic in some ways.
And I think there's also maybe a question that we need to think about quite how raw is raw data. You know, we're kind of constantly this fixating on the detail, this fixating on the data that Andrew was talking about. The data is seen as somehow kind of raw, and you can do whatever you like with it, but how raw is raw data? We've always processed data, and how should we be kind of processing our data to make it kind of as open to use and the creation of narrative as we can?